from KQED.
Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi just this morning said the nation is in a constitutional crisis. This comes a day after President Trump invoked executive privilege to block the release of the unredacted Mueller report to Congress, and a day after the House Judiciary Committee voted to hold Attorney General William Barr in contempt of Congress. Pelosi warned that House Democrats may hold more Trump administration officials in contempt if they continue to refuse to comply with committee subpoenas. Two law professors join us to talk about the president's use of executive privilege and whether we are indeed or aren't in a constitutional crisis. Victoria Norris is a professor of law at Georgetown Law School. Welcome to the program. Good to have you.
Thank you very much.
And we thank you. And we also welcome Saikrishna Prakash, who is a James Monroe Distinguished Law Professor at the University of Virginia. Welcome to the program, Professor Prakash.
Great to be here with both of you.
Good to have you both aboard here. And Professor Norris, Victoria Norris, let me begin with you. A simple question. Are we indeed in or on the brink of, on the precipice of a constitutional crisis? And let's define what that means in the context of the historical moment we're in.
Well, I think that's important to try to define it. The separation of powers is under stress. The kinds of disputes that we see today between the Congress and the president are negotiated. Indeed, every day, and I've been on both sides of Pennsylvania Avenue, these kinds of document requests are negotiated and assertions of executive privilege made. So in that sense, it's normal. What's not normal is that in this case, there has been a refusal to cooperate. It's not clear who's at fault, but the branches now are officially engaged in a "I am not cooperating" poise. And so what has to happen, in my view, is that they need to go to court. If the court decision comes out and the president were to refuse to comply with the court, as in Nixon not coming forth with the tapes, then we would be in a true constitutional crisis, in my view, because the court has no army. They cannot enforce its own orders. But we're not there yet. We are at the first chapter of a beginning of a stress test.
And you mentioned Nixon. The Mueller report, the judgment on that was not the final judgment. We know from the United States versus Nixon, the Nixon case says president cannot decide on his own, doesn't it?
That's absolutely true. The president asserted there the ultimate authority over the executive branch. And that claim was rejected in United States versus Nixon, that it was insufficient to make the case non-justiciable or something that the court couldn't decide. And the Supreme Court asserted rather bluntly there that it was the decision maker when it came to a criminal prosecution. Now, this is a slightly different case because we don't have an actual criminal prosecution. So it is a more conventional dispute between the Congress and the president. On the other hand, Congress's authority is very, very broad. The court has called it broad, far-reaching, penetrating. These are some quotes from various Supreme Court cases that go back over the history of the 20th century. So I think that the president's claims in some of these cases are quite weak, and that's the other problem. There are too many of these cases. This isn't something we haven't seen, blanket assertions of executive privilege, because that's also what Nixon said you can't do. You have to specify the document. You have to explain why this is a confidential presidential material, and we don't have that here. We've got a number of cases where the administration is either preemptively suing, as in the tax case, which is a fairly straightforward case as far as I can see, as well as a variety of other matters.
Victoria Norris.
That's unprecedented.
Is professor of law at Georgetown Law, and Sai Prakash is James Monroe Distinguished Law Professor at the University of Virginia. And we're not following precedent here, though, Professor Prakash. And the reality is that Congress supposedly has investigative powers. So what we're seeing is no documents being turned over to Congress, stonewalling, and it's going to be held up in the courts and tied up in the courts probably for quite some time, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think both sides are spoiling for a fight. I think Professor Norris is exactly right that before we've typically seen cases brought to the courts, the sides have tried to negotiate this out. I think the Democrats believe that there's no point in negotiation and they want a quick resolution, and the president likewise doesn't seem to be interested in negotiation. The courts themselves may try to encourage some sort of negotiated settlement so that they don't have to rule on the matter. But I think, you know, if you're the president, you're just trying to stall to see what happens in the elections next year. If you win, this investigation might go away. If you lose, the investigation will surely go away. If the Republicans win, they may be less interested in pursuing these matters.
Well, Speaker Pelosi said, and I'm quoting her here, my biggest fear is that if it were to go to court and the court were to affirm Congress's authority, the president would simply refuse. That is a possibility with this president.
I actually don't think so. I think, you know, there's a lot of inflated rhetoric on both sides. Nixon actually did suggest before the lower courts that he wasn't going to comply. I don't think the president has yet filed a brief saying, you can say what you want, but I'm not going to comply. And I think if he did that, he would be met with a lot of resignations in all the departments and in the White House itself. I think it's just a cornerstone feature of our system that when the court issues a judgment, the president complies. And of course, he might appeal the initial judgment, and I expect that he would if it was adverse. But the idea that he's not going to comply, I think, I don't see any evidence of it. He's complied with other judgments that he didn't like.
Well, there's also a contempt citation in the wings for Don McGahn, the president's former White House counsel, and we don't know if he's going to comply, but at this point, Attorney General Barr has ignored the deadline that the Intelligence Committee said they want to proceed. Where are they going to move on this, Victoria Norris? I guess contempt proceedings? Then what happens after that is voted in?
Well, you know, the thing is that if the House wants to get a resolution, as Professor Prakash noted, you need to move quickly. They need to issue, the committee has to issue a citation, then they go to the full House to vote, then they can go to court and seek a declaration. And if the case involves a lot of documents, that can take time, as we saw with the Holder case. The Holder case went until, you know, Trump was elected, so it disappeared.
You just mentioned Attorney General Holder was found in contempt over the firearm scandal known as Fast and Furious. Yeah, just wanted to clarify.
I apologize about that. Yes. No, thank you. Thank you. We do know these things take a lot of time, and his lawyers have probably told the president that's true. I do also think that we have other precedents. In Nixon, they actually acted fairly expeditiously. In the Clinton case involving her server, the courts acted very quickly. So I think in some of these cases, you might get a judgment sooner rather than later. But it's now on the House to step up its procedures and figure out how to do this. One of its problems is it has so many committees with so many subpoenas that they really have to make some command decisions about how their lawyers are going to pursue the litigation, and they should do it sooner rather than later.
All right. I want to invite our listeners to join us if you have some thoughts about what we're discussing here, which is the House Democrats actually voting not only to hold Attorney General Barr in contempt, but also declaring a constitutional crisis. That's from Nancy Pelosi and also from Jerry Nadler. Thoughts that you have and questions that you have are welcome, and let me tell you how you can join us right now. The toll-free number is available to you. It's 866-733-6786. We welcome your calls, your questions, your comments, and the number again is 866-733-6786. Or join us by email, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website and post any questions or comments you have there at kqed.org/forum. Click on the segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum. Let me go back, Sai Prakash, to you, if I may. And the president, Attorney General Barr said it's okay if Bob Mueller is called before Congress if he wants to testify, but the president has the executive authority to order him not to, doesn't he?
Well, I think he's trying to assert that authority. I think my recollection is that the papers were suggesting that White House officials were caught surprised by that tweet by the president. So I don't really know if the president's going to try to prevent Mueller from testifying. It's a little complicated, right, because the executive privilege is this idea that the president should be able to get confidential communications. But it only works if both the president and the person with the information agree to the assertion. That is to say, people violate the privilege all the time by revealing confidential information in books and to the newspapers, et cetera. And so nothing's to prevent Mueller, if he wanted to, just from spilling all the beans. I'm not saying he would do that, but I don't think the president can go to court to get an injunction against Robert Mueller to prevent him from testifying.
What about the fact that Nancy Pelosi reiterated, this was, of course, earlier today, not only her concerns, but also, and calling this a constitutional crisis, but also possibly leaving the door open for impeachment. She used this phrasing, which can't help focusing on talking about Trump self-impeaching himself. But the door is definitely open now, isn't it?
Well, I think the door has been open for a while in the sense that I think, you know, for the past several administrations, you've had many different occasions that Congress could have impeached and removed the president, in the sense that Congress thought that the president had done something illegal or unconstitutional, and usually the Congress just decided to look the other way. It could be starting a war without congressional authorization, you know, misconstruing statutes in various ways. And so I don't think the problem is whether the president has committed offense that Congress could regard as impeachable. The problem has always been political. Congress doesn't believe, or members don't believe, that it's a good use of their time, and that they think even if they impeach the president, it's not going to go through the Senate, so what's the point? And they're worried about the boomerang effect of an impeachment. They think about what happened to President Clinton, and more importantly, what happened to the Republicans in the wake of impeaching him.
Could I also ask you, if I may, Professor Norris, about Donald Trump Jr.? I mean, he's going to be fighting a subpoena now, presumably. What are the legalities of that? He's a private citizen. He's not the heir to the king.
Right. Yeah. Well, and that's you know, as you say, heir to the king, that's the problem with the continued pattern here, which is why it's different than Nixon or anything else. So this is also why you can see that there is an interest on behalf of the Congress to say, we have never been tested like this before by any president, because that's true. He's a private citizen. He could be subpoenaed. Now, is the Justice Department going to put him in jail? No. Can the House go and get a declaration that he's in contempt of Congress? Yes. It's fascinating that this is a Republican committee in some ways, but not in others, because there's a big intelligence issue here, and that is the Russians and our future election. And I think both Republicans and Democrats in the Senate agree that Russian interference in our election is a very serious issue. So to the extent that there is a witness who knows something about that, it seems highly within their competence and their interest in understanding it. So I think he is on very little ground. The president could assert something, but it would have to be after he's in office. And as far as I understand, the key issues are about what was going on with Moscow Tower, the Moscow Tower and investments in Russia, before the president took office, in which case those are not covered by executive privilege.
All right, I want to bring our callers aboard, and again, you can join us toll-free at 866-733-6786. Here's Alexis. Alexis, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. Great discussion, as always. I feel, tied to what you just said, I feel this all goes back to him never releasing his taxes, and in my mind, that potentially could be a form of collusion, depending on what his business dealings show as far as the businesses he was in, or the people he was engaged with in Russia, and how that ties to the indictments that have already been made with people in his cabinet and his associates. So by hiding that information, not releasing it, when he actually said that eventually he would, he lied about that as well, of course, they're withholding that information. So they all have the information, and basically the platform is just trust us. We don't have to show you anything. Just trust us. If the taxes show collusion potentially, then it implicates a lot of other people who have already seen his taxes as well. And I wish you could just comment on that.
Yeah, let me go to you on this, Professor Prakash. There is a possibility that the taxes, like the listener said, may indeed indicate not only relations with Russia, fiduciary and financial relations with Russia. They're trying to get information from Deutsche Bank along those lines, too, as well as the president's taxes. But they may be revealing things about emoluments, too. I mean, the taxes can play an extraordinary role in all this.
I think there is a sincere appetite to know what the president's doing with his taxes. And I think there are lots of people who think it's disqualifying that he didn't release them. There's a separate question of whether Congress is entitled to them, and what are they entitled to from either candidates or presidents. And I think if you step back for a moment, you can see the problem with what's going on here. I mean, imagine if the Republican Senate decided to look into the financial background of every single Democratic candidate on the grounds that they wanted to know information that would be relevant to people, for people to know when they ran for office. I don't I don't doubt the sincerity of people who want to know this information. And I can, you know, I can see why it would be quite useful in evaluating some candidate. But I don't know if Congress is the has authority to get private information in order to disseminate it publicly.
Well, at this point, you've got the head of the IRS, as well as, for that matter, the Secretary of the Treasury, Mnuchin, who are resisting, and those are pretty strong figures. Let me go to a couple comments here. There's a comment, and I go to you on this, Victoria Norse, from Karen, who writes, I want to know why William Barr, who is a political appointee, can see the report, but Congress, elected by the people, cannot. William Barr could be fired today, and he, as a private person, would have all this so-called secret information.
Well, that's exactly the sentiment behind Leader Pelosi's statement, which is that, sure, the president represents the nation, but as James Madison said, Congress was the closest to the people. And so it feels as if the people are being cut out in favor of the president's men. And that is a problem. I think ultimately, hopefully, the courts can get to resolve it. But it is a serious problem because it is ultimately should be the people's judgment about whether this president has violated laws in a serious way as to whether to impeach him. They can't decide whether to impeach him or whether he's committed obstruction of justice unless they have the underlying information. Let me just say one thing about the taxes. I don't think the president has a very good argument about resisting this particular statute. I think he's kind of made it up. And so I would be interested to see what's going on in the tax case, because there are concerns, not that it's collusion, because collusion is not a crime, but that the tax returns will reveal things that are very relevant to the Russia situation. And I keep going back to Russia. It's not about Republican or Democrat. It's about foreign alliances that are concerning a number of people in the Senate. And that's not private information.
Or, excuse me, that's leverage and possible blackmail as well, right?
Yeah.
I'm sorry to raise those, but those have been raised by others in the legislature. Yeah.
Yeah. The intelligence services and the directors of intelligence have skirted around this, but this has been public for some time inside the Beltway, which is that perhaps there's money laundering, all sorts of connections to Russia's that somehow revealed. I don't know how. I'm not a tax lawyer.
No, but Donald Trump Jr. did say that they've been doing a lot of business with Russia. He said this early on, even in the campaign, and there was that meeting with the lawyer in Trump Tower from Russia and so forth. But let me get another caller on here. Elizabeth wants to join us. Elizabeth, you're on.
Well, first, thank you for taking the call and for your show. I'm a regular listener and always enjoy it, and thank your guests as well. I, as a citizen, am very concerned that, you know, I watched the hearings as much as I could, a couple hours of them, when William Barr was testifying. And the disdain he showed for Congress was appalling. But then, in addition, to just flat-out refuse to comply with the request to provide the Mueller report. As a citizen, I feel Mueller worked for us. We, you know, we pay taxes to our government. That was that he was selected because of his experience. He spent 22 months providing that information. He prepared executive summaries that Barr refused to release. And then in addition to that, you know, Barr is refusing to let Congress, who should rightfully have access to that information, have it. So what can be done to address the issue of AG Barr, the highest member of the Justice Department of our land, who is refusing to comply with what I think are constitutional and legal situations?
Let me go to you, Professor Prakash.
Look, there's two issues. One, does the executive have an executive privilege? And then two, how does it relate to Congress's power of investigation? And as Victoria said, the Supreme Court has never decided whether executive privilege applies to Congress and its investigations or how it does. But what is clear is that Democratic and Republican presidents have resisted congressional investigations in the exact same way that the caller just described. Eric Holder would not turn over documents related to Fast and Furious. He was found in contempt of the House, and you know there's all these suits that were brought by the House to try to get that information. So I think it's a long-term problem. I think Victoria is right that the assertions of this administration are broader than in prior administrations, but the actual assertions themselves really aren't that different. You could replace Barr with Holder, and you could have the same caller ask the same question.
Let me thank Elizabeth for her call, and we'll go right to another caller. Mark, you're on.
Hi, my question relates to the documents in the possession of Don McGahn. that the White House has instructed him not to turn over. My question is, if he was an employee, a White House employee at the time those documents were produced, and not the personal attorney of the president, how is he in possession of those documents? How did he leave his workplace with work product that belongs to the government, and how are they possibly still covered by privilege?
Yeah, it's an important question. Victoria Norris, can I go to you?
Interesting question.
Yeah.
Hard question. They're covered by the Presidential Records Act. So if I were there, I would not be counseling him to take them home. So I don't know. Perhaps Sai Prakash knows what's going on here.
I would defer to Victoria. Whether they're covered by the act or not, the president could still claim privilege on them. So I don't think whether he succeeds or not is another question, but the fact that they're governmental records doesn't answer the question of whether they're privileged. And I think the fact that Barr works for the American people doesn't answer the question of whether Congress has a right to the documents. I personally believe that executive privilege shouldn't apply vis-a-vis Congress. But if you have that view, you have to have that view for Democratic presidents and Republican ones. It can't be a one-way street.
Remind listeners, we're talking about Nancy Pelosi's declaration that we're in a constitutional crisis with Victoria Norris, law professor at Georgetown Law, and Sai Prakash, who is law professor at the University of Virginia. A couple of quick comments from Margaret, who says, until the judiciary follows up with jail or impeachment, the showdown will continue. Ryan says, this administration thinks they are above the law, and unless Congress holds them accountable, they effectively are. Throw Barr in jail for a while and send the message that the law must be followed. Well, this is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. And we're going to go to another caller, and that's you. Excuse me, Dan, you're on the air. Good morning.
Thank you for taking my call. One of your guests said that it might be a sticky situation if we had Congress being able to do careful oversight, or I would call strict scrutiny of congressional financial records. He said that it appeared as if that were a bad thing. I don't think that's a bad thing. Money and politics, money in politics, that's kind of the rot that's at the center of the system. That's what Donald Trump has exposed through not observing a lot of the norms, for example, creating blind trusts or divesting from the immediate stuff. Maybe we should, you know, let sunlight in and clean things up. I'd like to hear your guests' thoughts on all that.
We'll hear from you first, Victoria Norris, on that.
What I think is fascinating about this period is that other presidents, such as Reagan, and I was a baby lawyer on Iran-Contra, he had his own investigation, and he revealed through his own investigation what was going on. I have no idea why this president didn't follow that precedent. So it has been the general wisdom in this town that sunlight is the best disinfectant, and that you don't want to waste your time on these big battles which end up in court, because it looks bad. It looks like stonewalling. I think the political calculus has changed such that this president thinks the fight is worth the battle. I personally don't have a problem with Congress looking into allegations where we've already had a special counsel and getting access to at least key items. I think that's what they've done in other investigations. They've done it in Teapot Dome in 1927. They've done it, you know, in Watergate. There was a joint committee in Watergate as well. What we've lost is the sense that Congress has a lot of power. You know, the president's been getting power for a very long time. And it's hard to cover Congress. There are 535 of them. People have disdain for Congress. But as some of the callers have suggested, it is Article 1 of the Constitution because these are the closest to the people, and they should have an important role to play. And now they're afraid that the president is shutting them out. So it's up to them to push back, and we'll see, you know, how this ends up in court.
We are supposed to be in a nation of balance of power, checks and balances, all the rest of that. And when you're talking about disproportionate power to any of the branches, whether it's legislative or executive or judicial, you're talking about real minefields. Let me get another caller aboard here. Randy joins us next. Randy, you're on.
Yeah, thank you. My question had to do with, at some point there was a statement, maybe it was right after Mueller was appointed, where it came out that Trump said, my presidency is over. And I've always wondered what he meant by that. And clearly he thinks he's not worthy of being president anymore, at least by some standard. And perhaps your panel could comment on that.
I have to confess, Randy, when he said that, I was also struck by it and wondered what the subtext might have been or what was going on in his head. And one should never guess, I think, what's going on in Donald Trump's head. It leads to too many errors. But Sai Prakash, you want to speculate here or give us some thoughts of yours?
I don't know what he meant, but I can give you an explanation that might be what he meant. When you hire a special prosecutor or an independent prosecutor, the tendency has been for that person to want to find a crime, in part to justify the investigation. And we've seen special prosecutors and independent prosecutors spend years trying to find some crime. We, of course, saw that during the Clinton era. And so I think, if my recollection is, the president said something like, I've been told that this is terrible for me. This is the end of my presidency. And I think he might have suspected that they were out to get him. I think he thought that the prosecutors that Mueller put together were biased against him. And so he probably thought that they were just going to dig until they found something amiss and then lay it on his doorstep. So that's the quote innocent explanation.
Well, and but there's another explanation. The other explanation is he may have felt they had whatever goods they, in his mind, might have had, right?
Well, of course. No, that is the alternative explanation.
If he were innocent as he claims, why would he have said that?
Yeah,
I think I would say the following: none of us want to be investigated by a special prosecutor who has an unlimited budget and who only has a limited target. I think that's a mistake to think that we would welcome this if we had nothing to hide.
Well, we'll have to leave it there.
Well,
but quick yeah. comment from you, Victoria. Sorry, go ahead.
Well, I think that any system can be abused, but when we're talking about, you know, funds going to our enemies and stealing an election, that's surely a case where we need a special prosecutor, even if we don't need them in many other cases.
We did only have seconds left, but Michael wants to know, how's the schedule of lower court cases, such as those in the Southern District of New York against Trump, and possible indictments play into the overall House legal strategy for impeachment and its schedule? Just quickly to you, Victoria, does it play in, do you think? Yes, no?
I don't know. I think they've got so much on their plate, they just have to organize.
Well, hey, yeah, we are in the midst of much on the plate, teeming as we have never seen before. Thank you both so much for being with us. Sri Prakash, again, is James Monroe, Distinguished Law Professor at UVA, University of Virginia, and Victoria Norris is Law Professor at Georgetown Law. And we are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. You can continue this discussion online at kqed.org/forum. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.